This episode features descriptions of sexual assaults and may not be appropriate for all listeners.
The phrase "judge, jury, and executioner" traces its origin back to the 1693 William Congreve play, The Double Dealer. In the play's epilogue, Congreve writes, "The law provides a curb for its own fury and suffers judges to direct the jury. But in this court, what difference does appear, for everyone's both judge and jury here, nay, and what's worse, an executioner." Now the phrase "judge, jury, and executioner" is used to describe the consolidation of all the power of the law into one person or one body. Most commonly, the phrase is used in the fictional realm. Think Charles Bronson or Bruce Willis delivering vigilante-style death wishes. Or Judge Dredd and the street judges of Mega City 1 deciding guilt or innocence and life or death in a matter of minutes. In the real world, it's becoming rarer and rarer that the long arm of the law can extend into all parts of a criminal adjudication process. But in Concord, North Carolina in 1976, there was one law that took a key decision out of the jury's hands and another that ensured that Ronnie Long might not have a jury of his peers. A change to that first law spared him his life, but the second law may have ensured that he lost his freedom.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Ronnie Long. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
This is episode 2 in our 4-episode series on the Ronnie Long case out of Concord, North Carolina. We ended episode 1 on May 10th, 1976, with Judy Bost wearing a disguise and identifying Ronnie Long as her assailant in a courtroom, a highly unusual identification procedure that is possibly unprecedented in American history. Bost then went to the police station and picked Ronnie Long out of a photo array. Meanwhile, after his court appearance, Ronnie Long went home to his family's house and, after an uneventful day, headed up to his room to take a nap. At around 6 p.m., Sergeant Taylor and Sergeant Lee, the same officers who were in the courtroom for that identification, showed up at his house.
Me and my mom walked out in the yard and they standing in the driveway. It's the same two, David Taylor and Marshall Lee. They tell me, "Ronnie, we need you to come back downtown and sign some papers and run to the police, pass them out." My mom said, "Yeah, you need a lawyer with him or somebody with him." "No, Miss Long, he don't need nobody with him. He ain't gonna be down there more than 10 or 15 minutes. Okay, you can either ride down with us or you can die down." I told my mom, "This is what I'm trying to, but when I need it, I'm going back to Charlotte because I have somebody to do a job. So when I get down, call me when you get there.
Ronnie's sister Linda was also home, and she has a similar recollection of the visit by the police officers.
"I had come down the street. I stayed up the street, and I was down here. And the police had come down here, and they knocked on the door. And they were saying they wanted to see Ronnie Long need to go uptown for the question. And my dad asked the question, 'Do I need to come with him?' And they said, 'No, because we're taking him uptown.' They lied. They said we're taking him uptown for no trespassing. And they took him up there and they locked him up for that, for the rape thing."
Colin also spoke to Ronnie's mother, Elizabeth. She's 86 years old now, but she still has a good recollection of the night her son was taken away.
"They came and told, asked me, was Ronnie at home? And I told. And they got Ronnie, they took him back uptown. And Ronnie, he told Ronnie, said, Ronnie said, asked that I couldn't drive the car up there. He drove the car up there, went up there. And when they took him up there, they kept him up there. They said he was the one that done it. But see, I don't know nothing about that. Because he didn't do it. I know he didn't do it.
So at about 6 p.m., the police got Ronnie to come to the police station under the false pretense that he needed to sign some paperwork connected to the trespassing charges that had been dropped earlier in the day. Then, once they got him there, their true intentions soon became clear.
when I get down there, Sonny Vogler tells me, Sonny Vogler is the lead detective. Sonny Vogler tells me to take everything out of my pocket. When I take everything out of my pocket, my keys at the table. David Taylor picked my keys up. Him and Jimmy Lee. Marshall Lee. I asked, well, man, hold it, man, where y'all going with my keys? This is the question that I had. They tell me, just be quiet, settle down, we'll be right back. They're just going down to look at your car. I told everybody, I ain't gave them to look at my car. I ain't gave nobody permission to look at my car. While we sitting there talking, he tell me I'm a suspect in a rape.
Now, this is the point where the stories of Ronnie and the officers diverge, and it's an important divergence because the search of the Long family car produced most of the evidence against Ronnie, other than Juddy Boss's identifications. And if Ronnie didn't consent to the search, the evidence recovered from that car would have been inadmissible against him, based on the Fourth Amendment. In fact, the defense would later make a motion to suppress this evidence, based on lack of consent. But the lead detective, Detective Vogler, would give a different story than Ronnie did on consent. According to his testimony on direct examination, quote, I don't know whether I could say exactly what Ronnie said. He gave us consent, said he didn't mind us searching his car. I don't know that that's the exact words he used or not. He gave us consent. This then led to the following exchange on cross-examination.
Lieutenant Vogler, when you say Ronnie Long gave you permission to search the car, where was he in the police station?
In the visiting agent's office.
Was his father present?
No, he was not present.
Was anybody present other than you?
I believe Sergeant Taylor was in there at the time.
Why do you not use consent to search forms at the police department?
Just never had one. I don't know why.
The subject of consent to search forms is interesting. The most comprehensive study of those forms was done by Nancy Leong and Kyra Sayeshi in their 2013 article, Consent Forms and Formalism. After speaking with officials in all 50 states, they determined that police departments in only 4 states do not use consent forms and rely only on verbal consent. North Carolina is not one of those 4 states, although clearly at least some North Carolina police departments did not use such forms in 1976. But even then, for the police department to rely on oral consent was anomalous because, as the article notes, between the Supreme Court's 1966 opinion in Miranda and its 1973 opinion in a case called Schneckloff, written consent forms had, quote, become an integral part of police culture. And it's easy to see why. The article cites a popular treatise targeted at law enforcement officials, which states, quote, as the burden of proof is on the prosecution to show that the consent was given voluntarily, this consent should be obtained in writing when possible and should be witnessed by more than one person. That wasn't the case here. So we're left with Ronnie's word against the words of the Concord Police Department when they searched Long family car and whether they had consent. Here's Ronnie describing the aftermath of that search.
He got the one called up, and David Taylor and Marshall Lee come back in to match it off with my jacket and my glove. They got on bundled up over my sundown.
So let's break down all the evidence the police say they recovered from the Long family car. First, over the sun visor of the passenger side seat, the police found black leather gloves. Now, as you might recall, Boss said that her assailant might have been wearing gloves. Specifically, the notes of her first police statement read as follows. Quote, subject was wearing a dark waist-length leather jacket, blue jeans, with a dark toboggan pulled low on his head, could possibly have been wearing gloves. So given that Boss was unsure about whether her assailant was even wearing gloves, this evidence doesn't seem too helpful, at least at first blush. The second piece of evidence the police recovered was a black leather jacket, although it's unclear whether Ronnie was wearing the jacket or whether it was in his car. As we just noted again, Boss said her assailant was wearing a black leather jacket. According to Ronnie's good friend, Terrence Stocks, this jacket was actually his.
Hello?
Hi, this is Colin Miller calling for Terrence Stocks.
Yeah, who is this?
I'm calling because I'm doing a podcast on the Ronnie Long case, and I'm trying to find the Terrence Stocks who knew him back in 1976.
Okay.
So you were a classmate of Ronnie Long's in high school?
Classmate and good friend.
And how would you describe Ronnie?
Ronnie was an upbeat guy. We all ran together. So, yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, it was cool. Matter of fact, the evidence that they have as far as the jacket, that's my jacket.
So you guys traded jackets back in 1976?
Yeah. 75, 76, yeah. We traded jackets. Yeah. And when he was arrested, that was my jacket he was wearing.
Do you know when you traded jackets?
We traded jackets during that year because he had a black LTD Ford, and the jacket was black. I had a green Eldorado, and he had a green patchwork brown-type jacket that we traded. I bought that jacket when I was in the military in Germany.
Now, this is interesting, but probably not for the reason you might expect. Ronnie acknowledges he had exchanged jackets with Terrence before the assault, so there's no question about whether Ronnie had the jacket at the time of the assault. The interesting thing is that it turns out that Terrence's wife is now the deputy chief of police of the Concord Police Department, the very same police department that Ronnie Long has been fighting for over four decades. Now, in terms of the relevance of the jacket, I guess it's a judgment call. Obviously, Boss picked Ronnie out of a photo array in part based upon the jacket, which means it likely looks similar to her assailant's jacket. That said, from testimony and images of the jacket, there's nothing distinctive about it that would distinguish it from many other black leather jackets. There was also some other evidence the police recovered from the Long family car. You might recall that the police recovered partially burned matches by the banister at the front of the Boss residence, which they believed the assailant used to light his way in the dark. The police recovered five matchbooks from the floorboards of the Long family car, and Lieutenant Vogler would later testify as follows at trial.
The matches we found at Mrs. Bost's had, well, one side was, to my recollection, was sort of a blue on one side and maybe natural grayish color on the other side, and the matchbooks we found in the car contained the same type of match.
In other words, according to Vogler, there's a solid chance the matches from the crime scene came from one of these matchbooks, which I can imagine finding reasonably compelling as a juror.
As many of you know, I am a working mom, juggling a whole lot of stuff in my life, and I had a baby last year, and guess what? He just turned one. So baby's first birthday is coming up, and I can't tell you how much easier my life has been made just organizing the party because of Stamps.com. I use Stamps.com to send out all of the invitations for his first big birthday bash. Because I could do it in the middle of the night when he's sleeping. I could do it during the day when he's taking a nap. I never had to think about going anywhere outside of my house to have to mail out all the invitations. Everything I did from the comfort of my own home. Now look, basically none of us can survive without the U.S. Postal Service. Whether you're running a business or just like handling your household business, I mean, like, we need the Postal Service. And Stamps.com is the easiest way to access all of the amazing services of the post office, and it never closes. So you print your postage, letters, or packages at your convenience 24/7. And yes, packages. So you can send packages using Stamps.com. You can send them internationally too, which is kind of amazing. Not just domestic stuff. All you gotta do is click print, mail, and you're done. It takes minutes to open a Stamps.com account, and you've got no equipment to lease. You've got no long-term commitments. Basically, you've got nothing to lose and a whole lot of time to gain in your life. And our listeners right now can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. All you got to do is go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com and enter undisclosed. This then leaves us with the infamous toboggan. Again, you might recall the Boss said her assailant was wearing a dark toboggan. The police say they recovered a green toboggan from under the driver's seat of the Long family car. Ronnie has always maintained that the toboggan wasn't his and that he had never seen it before the officers showed it to him. The most interesting thing about the toboggan is that it has hairs in it that don't appear to be African American and instead appear reddish. Over the years, Ronnie has been unsuccessful in seeking testing of these hairs. Colin asked Ronnie's attorney, Jamie Lau, about the toboggan.
Prior counsel for Mr. Long has sought testing of hairs in that toboggan that don't appear to be the hairs of Ronnie Long. The issue is that that toboggan had been placed on Heggs and handled during the course of trial. Ronnie, of course, has never seen the toboggan prior to trial. It's not Mr. Long's toboggan. He's said that since the very beginning of the case. Given the fact that it's not his toboggan, it's not unexpected that there are hairs there that don't necessarily appear to be from an African-American male. But because of the handling during the course of trial, the court has not allowed for DNA testing to go forward with respect to the hairs in the toboggan to identify those hairs. Interestingly, of course, is the fact that Mr. Long has acknowledged that the gloves, the jacket, the evidence collected in this case were items of his, yet the toboggan he's consistently has denied ever seeing, to the extent that he would be trying to suggest that items were not necessarily his. He could have denied ownership of gloves collected from the car as well. You know, it's a toboggan that he's never seen before. I mean, I don't know what to say about the hairs other than there are hairs in there. They're not an African-American male's hairs, but the court won't let us test to identify who those hairs may belong to.
The toboggan is an especially sore subject for Ronnie.
The green hat, the green toboggan, they said it took out of my car. They said it took it out of my car. They were in their possession, you know, stuff said, ever since they took it out of my car. The woman did not say anything about a green toboggan. The woman said a dark colored toboggan. They got a lime green hat now. The lime green hat, and the whole time I'm telling my lawyer, that ain't my hat, man. I ain't never seen that hat before. You understand? But yet, still, when my lawyer turned it inside out, he turned it inside out, trial transcript, page 310. You understand? Said Sergeant Taylor said that he saw light colored hair in the toboggan. Okay, we tried to get the hair, get the body DNA tested. Okay, but the Superior Court judge, he gonna try to make a statement about your lawyer put the hat on his head. That contaminated the hat. Okay, get the lawyer's DNA. Get the lawyer's DNA, you understand? So if his DNA show up in the hat, then get his DNA and compare it with the other DNA that's in the hat. The main issue is the thing right here. This is what we were trying to prove, that the hat didn't belong to me and that my DNA was in the hat. But they refused to let me do that because they talk about they ain't going on no fishing expedition. Come on, man.
Now, there are a few other important things to note about the toboggan. The first is that several witnesses, both friends and family, say they had never seen Ronnie with the toboggan. One of those family members is his sister, Linda.
At trial, they said they had recovered this green toboggan from the car and said that that was the toboggan worn by the person who committed this crime. Had you ever seen Ronnie with a toboggan?
No, Ronnie didn't have that toboggan. He didn't even own that toboggan.
And one of those is friends Terrence Stocks.
They said that he committed this crime while wearing a toboggan, and I think you testified at trial that you didn't remember ever seeing him wear a toboggan.
I think that toboggan was green, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah, and there was they said something about a testimony of a different color hair, sandy colored hair in that toboggan.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, yeah.
And you don't remember ever seeing Ronnie wearing anything like that, right?
No. Most of the time, it was more of a cap or a hat, like, you know?
Ronnie's recollection of the type of hat he used to wear in 1976 matches up with Terrence's recollection.
What was the type of hat that you did wear back in 1976?
Leather-looking baseball cap. I used to wear leather-looking caps. I used to wear a leather cap, you understand? See, it looked like a little chauffeur's cap. Then I used to wear the other-looking baseball cap. We had these brown leather caps that we used to wear, like baseball caps. Those are the kind of caps I used to wear then.
At trial, the defense would introduce a leather chauffeur's cap into evidence, and several witnesses identified it as a cap that Ronnie wore in 1976, and indeed, even on the day of the assault. One of those witnesses, again, was Terrence Stocks, who, as we'll explain in more detail later, saw Ronnie with a chauffeur's hat both a couple hours before and a couple hours after Juddy Boss was assaulted. But another thing to reiterate about the car is that it wasn't Ronnie's car. It was his mother's.
That was my car. I bought that car.
And as Ronnie's wife likes to stress, this means it was a shared car.
Ronnie, his father, and his brothers all drove that vehicle.
Therefore, it's possible the toboggan came from any number of passengers while any number of different people were driving the car. After the Concord police collected these items, Ronnie was arrested and taken to Kannapolis for arraignment the next day. He still has a visceral memory of this nearly 42 years later, as can be seen in this recorded call that he did with his wife.
They took me to Kannapolis, North Carolina, for arraignment. First thing Tuesday morning. While I'm sitting in a holding cell in Kannapolis.
In the basement.
Dad, I felt as though we were like underground or in a basement or something because it was real damp. You could smell a lot of like mold, mildew. While I'm in the holding cell, Van Eisenhower, who is the evidence custodian for Cabarrus County, Concord Police Department. He come in with a pair of brown boots, drop them on the floor in front of me and tell me he needs the shoes that I got on.
Well, Tom, what he said to you?
I told him that them shoes are mine. I don't know whose shoes are mine. I keep the shoes off in front of him. He told me he get the shoes one way or another. Either way or the hard way. Either way it goes, I'm leaving him with the shoes. I stood up, told him, okay, come and get him. He looked back outside the door and called in two shirts. Both of them look like they weigh about 300 pounds. Me being from Concord, 8 miles from Kannapolis, I've heard the rumors about what happened to people in North Kannapolis, especially blacks. I'm not getting ready to be a victim, so I sit down and take the shoes off.
As we'll explain when we get to the trial, these shoes are the last piece of evidence that the state had against Ronnie Long. Ronnie was next arraigned for first-degree burglary and rape, and he was taken back to Concord. Soon thereafter, he was offered a plea deal, and it might be an indication of the strength or weaknesses of the state's case against him.
A day or so later, a lawyer named Johnson, whom my father had retained to represent me, came to me with my father and told me that the DA would offer me 7 years for a guilty plea. He told me that I would be out of penitentiary for 3.
Ronnie could have taken the plea deal and gotten a 7-year sentence, and only around 3 years of actual prison time, if he'd simply plead guilty. But anyone who knows Ronnie knows that this isn't something he'd ever have done.
They offered me a 7-year plea for a guilty plea. 7 years, so I'd be back home in 3 years. My dad looked at me and told me, "Say, ain't no way in the world. I didn't raise y'all to admit that y'all did something when you didn't do it." So I didn't take the plea. I went to trial.
To understand the gravity of this decision, we need to go back in time, all the way back to the antebellum South. At the time, there were two sentencing schemes in many southern states for the crime of rape, and that led to oral arguments before the United States Supreme Court in 1972, when a man named William Henry Furman challenged Georgia's current sentence of capital punishment for rape.
Before the Civil War in the state of Georgia, there were two sets of statutory penalties for the crime of rape. If a slave or a free person of color raped a white woman, he was to get the death penalty. Any other rape was punishable by a term of 1 to 20 years. After the Civil War, the statutory scheme, which was on the books of the state of Georgia, was repealed, and the essentially statutory scheme that we have at this point was reenacted take its place. And we have all these statutes set forth verbatim in the appendix at the end of our brief. The discretionary death penalty for the crime of rape was enacted into Georgia law. And what has happened in the administration of the statute, this discretionary statute, has been essentially what was required under the particular language of the Georgia legislation that existed prior to the Civil War. Looking at capital punishment in general, that is for the crime of rape and the crime of homicide, we find that while it is authorized for one purpose or another in most of the states, it is in fact almost never applied, except in a random unstandardized way, against the poorest, the least educated, and disproportionately against racial minorities.
Concluding the imposition of the death penalty was both arbitrary and discriminatory, the Supreme Court placed a moratorium on the death penalty in 1972. Defendants could still be sentenced to die, but those executions couldn't be carried out until the states came up with a fairer system. In response, some states like North Dakota repealed their death penalties. Other states tried to create better sentencing schemes to enable jurors to apply clear criteria in choosing between life and death. Meanwhile, North Carolina doubled down, finding a unique way to insulate its death penalty from claims that it was arbitrary and discriminatory. It made the death penalty mandatory in cases of first-degree murder and first-degree rape. As a result, North Carolina's death row population swelled to 120, the largest in the nation. When Ronnie Long turned down a deal that would have had him out in about 3 years, he did so while believing that a conviction for rape would cost him his life. He also did so knowing that this was going to be a high-profile case. Again, here's Ronnie's wife.
And during the time that Ronnie was on trial, waiting trial, there was actually rioting and protesting going on in Concord, so much so that the city enforced a curfew and the National Guard was brought in.
One article from the summer notes that, quote, an estimated crowd of 300 persons, consisting mostly of persons under 22 years of age, assembled in front of the Cabarrus County Courthouse to rally in support of Ronnie Wallace Long. Only a smattering of whites joined in the march. Police estimate that around 75 persons joined in the march as the demonstrators moved through the predominantly black section of Concord. Occasionally breaking into choruses of We Shall Overcome, the demonstrators were chanting Free Ronnie Long and Where People United Will Never Be Defeated. The article cites one protester as saying this was the biggest demonstration he'd seen in such a case, and a speaker informing the crowd of what he termed Klan-style justice. This wasn't a hyperbolic claim. As we noted in the first episode, the victim in this case, Juddy Bost, was the widow of an executive accountant at Cannon Mills, the textile company that was the main employer in Cabarrus County. Given this fact, you might imagine that Ronnie's lawyer would have moved to transfer venue to another county. But one of Ronnie's trial lawyers would later testify that he didn't make such a motion because the alternative was Rowan County, which had a large Cannon Mills plant and it was known for, quote, some pretty heavy Klan activity. So the trial took place in Cabarrus County, which created some problems because it was effectively a company town. Here's Ronnie's wife talking to students at Winston-Salem State.
And Cannon Mills, like, literally, like, they used to be the world's largest producer of towels until they sold the mills, I think it was, like, 2008. So, I mean, essentially, like, we all would have used towels that came out of there, definitely your parents and everything. I mean, they actually incorporated the city of Kannapolis, which is right next to Concord. Like, they actually created the city of Kannapolis. And there's a whole bunch of mill houses. I mean, the police used to go pick up their checks from the plant. I think it was Plant 2 in Kannapolis.
Indeed, at a hearing after trial, one of Ronnie's trial attorneys was testified that there was, quote, a real or perceived feeling that Cannon Mills ran the county, and it would have been difficult to keep these kinds of feelings out of the courtroom. You know, it's not easy to get folks to agree on much of anything nowadays, but if there is anything we could all agree on, it's this. We all need more sleep. And getting a great night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you think, because you don't need an expensive new mattress and you don't need sleeping pills. What you need to do is change your sheets. That's why you should check out Boll & Branch. Every single thing that Boll & Branch makes, from the bedding to the blankets, it's made out of 100% pure organic cotton. So they start off really super soft when you get them, and they just get softer over time. And you buy directly for them, so you're kind of cutting out the middleman and you're paying wholesale prices. You're getting luxury sheets that honestly can cost up to like $1,000 in the store, but Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple of $100. Everybody who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. They have thousands of five-star reviews, and Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company are all talking about Boll & Branch. Even three U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch sheets, and hey, so do I. Now, shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a refund, but I doubt you're going to want to send them back. Still, there's no risk and there's no reason to not give them a try. So, to get you started, right now, my listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at bollandbranch.com using the promo code undisclosed. Go to bollandbranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's boll, B-O-L-L, and branch.com and use the promo code undisclosed. Bollandbranch.com, promo code undisclosed.
The
So as Ronnie's case hurtled towards trial, the deck looked pretty stacked against him, although he finally did catch one break. North Carolina's hubris in making death penalty mandatory for certain crimes came back to bite it. On July 2nd, 1976, the United States Supreme Court issued its opinion in Woodson v. United States. In Woodson, James Tyrone Woodson had been drinking heavily when Lubby Waxton and Leonard Tucker arrived at his trailer. According to the Supreme Court's decision, when Woodson came out of the trailer, Waxton struck him in the face and threatened to kill him in an effort to make him sober up and come along on a robbery. Fearing for his life, Woodson came along but remained in the car with the fourth man as lookouts while Waxton and Tucker entered an Easy Shop. Once inside, Waxton asked for a pack of cool cigarettes, but as the cashier approached him, he pulled out a nickel-plated Derringer and fatally shot her before emptying the cash register. Based on his involvement in the crime, Woodson was convicted of first-degree murder and given the mandatory sentence of the death penalty. In the summer of 1976, the Supreme Court deemed that sentence unconstitutional. Here's a clip from a WRAL story on Woodson and his case.
James Woodson was sentenced to die for a store robbery in 1974, even though he never got out of the getaway car. Under North Carolina's old law, he was given a date with the electric chair. In 1976, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down North Carolina's law, sparing Woodson's life and 120 others.
Praise God, how you doing?
17 years after the ruling, Woodson was free.
Praise God, how you doing? After 18 years of incarceration, somebody tells me that I'm going home.
Woodson admits it was not easy on him or his wife.
I thought I was going home as a husband, but I actually went home, you can say, as her son, because she had to help me to readjust.
I'm saying.
WRAL first met James Woodson 11 years ago. He was the kitchen manager at the Raleigh Rescue Mission. These days, he has a job in Raleigh and preaches to inmates at Wake Correctional Center. He's also watching the latest court case involving 27 inmates. The lead plaintiff in the dispute, Bobby Bowden, is one of the inmates whose life was spared by the James Woodson decision in 1976.
Ronnie Long was another one of those inmates who had his life spared by the Woodson decision. He was no longer eligible for the death penalty, but his charge of first-degree rape and burglary now carried mandatory life sentences, which, under North Carolina law, meant 80 years for each crime. Under this new North Carolina system, jurors still wouldn't be deciding Ronnie Long's sentence, but they would be deciding his guilt or innocence. North Carolina, though, had another law in place at the time, and it's one that raises a whole host of different questions about the jury who would decide his fate.
Those three people in the county's commissioner's office are supposed to compose jury pools for jury duty, prospective jurors for jury duty. I got documentation to prove that the chief of police went to the county commissioner's office and took the master list of prospective jurors and started deleting names from the list, saying that he knows these people personally. I have documentation to prove this. That he deleted names from the master list of prospective jurors for jury duty on my case.
Ronnie's right. He does have documentation to back up this claim. And here's what it shows. Typically, jury selection works as follows. Somebody, in this case, the jury commission, creates jury rolls or jury veneers based upon things like property records, voter records, or DMV records. The jury roll or jury veneer is the master list of prospective jurors in a given case. Then, in open court, both the prosecution and the defense are entitled to make two types of challenges or strikes to prospective jurors. The first are unlimited for-cause challenges, based upon prospective jurors being statutorily unqualified to serve because, for instance, they don't live in the relevant jurisdiction, they're connected to one of the parties, or they have pre-existing prejudicial knowledge about the case. The second are peremptory challenges, which are a limited number of challenges that can be made without providing a reason and might be based upon things like thinking a prospective juror's job makes her more likely to be pro-prosecution or pro-defense. But in the Ronnie Long case, there was an initial filter before the defense ever got to see the jury veneer. Here's Ronnie's attorney, Jamie Lau, explaining the process in more detail.
The jury rolls through which the jury pool was selected were first taken to the county sheriff and potentially the police department as well. There's another case in North Carolina from about the same time where the police chief had also made a pass through the jury rolls. And the law enforcement officers who were able to take a pass through the jury rolls used a red pen or pencil or struck through whatever jurors they deemed unfit for jury service. There was a statute in place at the time that identified what would disqualify individuals from jury service. So conceivably, they could be striking through the names on the basis of permissible reasons under the statute. But there's no way in which to determine how law enforcement officials were striking names. What we know is that they had gone through the list and struck potential jurors from the jury pool prior to the pool being called.
Simply put, this is an extremely unorthodox practice you're unlikely to find authorized anywhere today or even anywhere other than North Carolina back in 1976. It's tough to even find something analogous in a single other case. All I could find was one case out of Georgia in which a sheriff was allowed to strike five prospective jurors. In finding this behavior unconstitutional, the Supreme Court of Georgia ruled in 1983 that the excusal of five prospective jurors by the sheriff as the chief law enforcement officer in the county and as a direct participant in the trial is a violation of the integrity of the jury selection process and constitutes an alteration of the array of traverse jurors to such an extent as to deprive this defendant of her proportional share of peremptory strikes. Of course, this case was a one-off and not a codified law like the one in the Ronnie Long case. At least in most cases, North Carolina defendants were able to check the homework of the sheriff and see the names of prospective jurors who were struck. But that wasn't true for Ronnie Long.
The chairman in charge of the jury rules testifies at trial that he can't produce the list and the individual jurors who had been struck from that list because he recently had moved offices and couldn't find the list, which raises a great deal of questions about who was struck from the jury rolls by these law enforcement officers prior to the jury pool in Ronnie's case ever being called for jury duty. Of course, you're entitled to a jury that's a representative cross-section of the community, and if those jurors were struck from the rolls for any reason other than permissible reasons under the statute, then Mr. Long's rights were violated even before his trial began.
It's easy to imagine how this dog ate my homework excuse could have hidden something nefarious by returning to Georgia for a more recent case. In Foster versus Chapman, Timothy Tyrone Foster appealed his convictions for murder and burglary and was able to get the prosecutor's list of jurors that he struck. Here's Chief Justice Roberts explaining what Foster found and how it meant the court had to rule.
In this case, however, we have a copy of the file used by the prosecution during jury selection. That file contains the following documents. First, lists containing the names of each prospective juror. The names of the black prospective jurors are highlighted in bright green with the notation that green highlighting, quote, represents blacks, end quote. Second, a list titled Definite No's. That list contains six names, including the names of each black prospective juror. Third, a typed document stating that, quote, if it comes down to having to pick one of the black jurors, end quote, one particular one might be acceptable. Fourth, handwritten notes identifying three black prospective jurors as B number one, B number two, and B number three. Fifth, questionnaires filled out by several black prospective jurors. On each, the prospective juror's race is circled. And sixth, a handwritten document containing the following note, quote, no black church, end quote, referring to the church to which one of the black prospective jurors belonged. The word black is underlined. Now, in light of the documents in the file and our independent examination of the record, we conclude that the prosecution's purportedly race-neutral reasons for striking at least two of the black prospective jurors, Marilyn Garrett and Eddie Hood, were pretextual, and that the strikes were instead based on at least substantial part on racial discrimination.
Now, of course, you might say that it's unfair to ascribe prejudicial motives to the sheriff in this case, but what seems far fairer to say is that bias, both unconscious and conscious, comes into play whenever you give largely unbridled discretion to someone who clearly has a stake in the outcome of a case. In this regard, it's important to note that the sheriff was given authority to strike prospective jurors on two counts. First, if they were unqualified. And second, if they fell into another category. The title of that category? The undesirable. Here's a jury commission chairman describing how the sheriff or chief of police determines whether prospective juror is, quote, undesirable.
Do you know what standards applied by the sheriff and chiefs of police in determining who is undesirable as opposed to who is legally disqualified?
Well, as far as I know, the sheriff and the chief are well qualified to determine whether a person is desirable or undesirable.
And that's it. So imagine you're the sheriff and you've been given a jury role with the names of people who have spoken against police misconduct, people who have spoken in favor of civil rights, law-abiding citizens who would generally seem more inclined to favor the defense than the prosecution. Would you be able to resist the temptation to stack the deck in favor of the state? Because the original list with the red marked names is lost to time, we'll never know what the sheriff did in the Ronnie Long case. And here's the thing, neither did the trial judge. And what that means is that he shouldn't have taken the state at its word and should have quashed the veneer and started the jury selection process all over again. But he didn't. And that then takes us to what we know did happen.
Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030.
There were only four prospective African-American jurors called to the jury box to be questioned for jury selection, and all four of them were struck by the prosecution. And if you're wondering whether the defense questioned these challenges on equal protection grounds, this was a decade before the Supreme Court even recognized that this was a viable issue in the case of Batson v. Kentucky. And so Ronnie Long ended up with a jury of 12 white jurors and one white alternate juror, despite the fact that Cabarrus County was about 15% African-American at the time. According to Ronnie Long, the jury selection process and the resulting jury was inconsistent with his right to a fair trial.
The deck is stacked against me, man. It was stacked against me from the day one. Ain't no sheriff got no business picking names off a jury list. I ended up with 13 whites. You know, they say, those jurors are your peers.
Ronnie Long's belief that an all-white jury prevented him from receiving a fair trial is backed up by empirical data. Colin spoke with Patrick Bayer. He's a professor of economics at Duke, who did a study on the effect of all-white juries on trials over a 10-year period.
When it's an all-white jury pool, you get about an 18% gap. So black defendants are convicted 18% more often than whites. And even with just some representation of the pool, not even necessarily on the case itself, you basically get, you know, kind of conviction rates that are slightly higher for white defendants in that case. So you get this huge change in the outcome of the case just based on the randomness of who's in the jury pool, you know, who's called for jury duty that day.
So let's break that down. Professor Bayer studied data from jury trials in Florida over the course of a decade. When there was even one African-American juror in the jury pool, the conviction rates for Caucasian and African-American defendants were similar. In fact, the conviction rate for Caucasian defendants was 2% higher. But when there were no African-Americans in the jury pool, the conviction rates for African-Americans was 18% higher than it was for their Caucasian counterparts. And according to Professor Bayer, this same gap exists when there are no African-Americans in the jury selected from that jury pool, which was what happened in the Ronnie Long case.
In the raw data, you can kind of you know, there's a similar effects for the seated jury as well. So if you were just to look at, you know, compare the trials with, like, basically, in, you know, over 80% of the trials, it's an all-white jury pool. And if you were to compare those trials with the ones where there's a black member of the jury, you get kind of, you know, big effects for those as well.
Finally, there's one last thing to note about the jury in the Ronnie Long case, and it's quite possibly even more important than its racial composition.
Four of the jurors worked for Charles A. Cannon, who employed the victim's husband, who was an executive accountant for Charles A. Cannon. It was also rumored that Charles A. Cannon offered a $10,000 reward for information leading up to an arrest.
Breaking that down, three of the 12 jurors in Ronnie Long's case were currently employed by Cannon Mills, and a fourth was married to a current Cannon Mills employee. That's a third of the jurors connected to Cannon Mills, and imagine being in their shoes. There was a real or perceived belief that Cannon Mills ran the county, and a belief that Charles Cannon was offering money for information leading to the arrest of the man who raped the widow of his former executive accountant. The case was dominating the headlines of the papers, and there were marches through Concord streets throughout the summer. If you were a juror employed by Cannon Mills or married to a Cannon Mills employee, would you have been willing to be the holdout, the one thing preventing the person accused of that crime from being convicted? And what if the accused had an alibi? A good one, that covered not just the time of the crime, but the entire day. Next time on Undisclosed.
Thanks so much to all of you for tuning in this week, and we have a whole host of other people to thank for making this season possible, as they do every season. First of all, thank you to our sponsors for helping bring us back week after week. Thank you, Baluki, for designing our logo. Thank you, Chrissy, for maintaining our website. Thanks so much, Mithil Thelhan, our amazing executive director. A big thanks to Mr. Henry Lavoie for helping with research for this series. And if that name sounds familiar, it should be, because he is the son of our awesome audio producer, Rebecca Lavoie, who is not just our audio producer, but also the host and producer of the fantastic podcast, Crime Writers On, which I don't miss any week. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Our Twitter handle and Facebook is at Undisclosed Pod. And if you have questions for the addendum, don't forget to get Mr. John Cryer's attention and our producer attention by tagging them with hashtag UD Addendum. Thanks so much. Until next week.